And I appreciate Brother Cates and his scholarship on this particular book. We trust that the lesson tonight on Job's wife, her suffering, and his support will be a benefit to all of us as we continue our study during this lecture series on this important, timely, relevant, and meaningful book. In the earliest society of man in the ancient Near Eastern world, which has rightly been called the cradle of civilization, there were a number of social institutions that became the very substance of foundations in every established social order. Such institutions as the divine institution of religion, the social and political institutions which ordered societies and for which Brother Kevin Colley prayed in our opening prayer tonight, the soon apparent need for an economic institution to give material framework to the social fabric, and finally the institution of law to govern the functions and conduct of men and women in civil society. However, in all of recorded human history, and especially so in the ancient Near Eastern and Mediterranean world, there was no institution as respected and protected as that of the family made up of parents, children, extended family, and this was the case in many cases, family members, multi-generational, living together. In fact, it was the extended family that provided security, longevity, and tradition to respective family lineages, and therefore to society as a whole. In studying the institution of the family, and that's where we're going to begin tonight, in talking about Job's wife, the societies of the ancient Near East and the Mediterranean world, one gains great insight and understanding by examining the books which make up what we refer to as the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament. Family life in the Bible is presented in a multifaceted way so that what it is at once a complex issue in many ways is broken down in its constituent elements throughout the biblical text. The foundation of the family institution as set up by God Himself is seen in the opening chapters, for instance, of the book of Genesis. Particular attention should be given to the inspired commentary of Jesus regarding the family institution and the sanctity of the family institution, the family of God, as mentioned by Jesus in Matthew chapter 9, and then in Matthew chapter 19, verses 1 through 12. The order and structure of the family institution may be observed on a practical level as well as understood from an objective point of view, looking at the numerous family statutes, for instance, in the Torah, in such books as Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. If we remember back to the society of ancient Israel, they were first and foremost Jacobite patriarchs who came into what was known as the Promised Land. The Passover and the Exodus out of Egypt helps to form these clans or tribes into a cohesive whole. This took place, of course, at Horeb or Sinai, where God's appearance at the mount and the giving of the law and the various and sundry laws which helped to order the fabric of this new nation gained sway. No longer were the families of Israel to be understood in terms of nomadic clans who were regularly on the move and influenced by their ever-changing geographic movement. Rather, when Israel went into the Promised Land, particularly the books of Joshua and Judges chronicle this history, the conquest and possession of the Promised Land is important as far as the establishment of the family institution is concerned. Israeli families could settle on a much more long-term basis in a particular area or region. We find that as the family unit became more geographically and therefore economically stable, families could then look beyond themselves to issues of greater benefit and welfare for the nation as a whole, including but not limited to economic, trade, and military concerns. Of course, the common bond that united all families and extended families was their primary focus upon God. And friends, this has remained a constant, even extending into our own day and time throughout human history. Prior to the conquest and possession of the Promised Land, Israel had become more aware of the presence of God. And to solidify His consistent presence among the people, God had given His law, number one, the Torah. Number two, He had planned and executed the building of the tabernacle, along with the requisite remedial sacrificial system. And then number three, God had instituted the Levitical priesthood as another means of reflecting His presence among the people. I want to look next at the family as seen in the book of Job. In the opening two chapters of the book of Job, and these two chapters are going to occupy primarily our attention this evening, there is information regarding family order, family care, family structure, family worship, family economics, family relations, family rights, and family confidence between the patriarch Job, his wife, and their own extended family relations. Although the book of Job was written before the conquest and possession of central Palestine, the book itself nevertheless represents vestiges of institutional family interaction that are important in determining the antiquity of basic and fundamental family institutional practices. By that we mean that the principles that God laid down in the long ago, even before the conquest and settlement of central Palestine, were older than the conquest and settlement of the Promised Land. God's divine plan and purpose for the family as presented to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden extend even to our own day and time. And that is why we emphasize in the book of Job, in this and other lectures, the sanctity and the preservation of the family institution. The book of Job opens by presenting a particular family, the family of Job, in a state of what we might call peaceful communion and mutual love and concern and respect for one another. Now, this picture is presented, of course, before a series of events which took place that, as we read, appear to have happened in such a short span of time that both decimated and tested this particular family as nothing that they had ever experienced before. And when this decimation was concluded, there remained the husband Job and his wife. Job himself was a patriarch, a contemporary of Abraham. And there are several great questions dealt with in the book of Job. First of all, we want to bring before our minds tonight an important question. Will a man serve God for God's sake alone? There are many, in fact, there are many even today who would answer this question with an automatic no. Second, why should an innocent individual suffer? Even in our world today. Now, the first question implies other questions, such as, is there such a thing as purely disinterested goodness? Again, would you serve God if God made no promise of heaven or of an eternal reward? Or would you serve God because it is just the right thing to do? And again, many people would automatically answer, no, there would be no motivation, there would be no compelling or impelling reason to so do. Well, the second question, why should an innocent individual suffer, implies other questions. These would include, why do good people suffer? Why do people who seek to do right suffer? And Why is it that I, as a Christian today, experience so much suffering in my life? I want to take just a moment, and we were privileged to be able to write several manuscripts for this good book, and as I've had time to look through the manuscripts of the many authors, this is a wonderful book to have in your library. There are few on the book of Job, and this one, I believe, is going to be a signal volume. But if you have your book, on page 179, I've entitled the section Suffering in the Book of Job. I want to take just a moment, and I want to go into what we mean by suffering in this particular book. Because there are some who believe that Job is just about a book of suffering. But it's not just about a book of suffering, or it's not just a book about an individual or a husband and a wife who suffer. Job is many times characterized as a book dealing with human suffering, and this suffering is oftentimes characterized in a very general, non-specific way. However, upon a careful reading of the book, the Job text is not about human suffering in a generic sense, but rather the suffering that is described in the book of Job is of a specific type. And I would say that it is the most difficult type of suffering that you and I are called upon to endure. And let me just say at the very beginning, this is the suffering of Christ. When Peter, in his epistle, denotes Christ who suffered through no direct fault of his own, and then tells you and I, as individual Christians today, that we are to walk in the footsteps of Jesus in this type of suffering, that is meaningful for us today. It's one thing to suffer as a direct consequence of our own actions. However, it is another thing totally to suffer and not know the reason why. Job is about a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, both in relationship to God in the patriarchal sense, who suffer through no direct fault of their own. We suffer today, but many times we bring suffering upon ourselves. And so it is that we can bring to our conscious mind and our conscious awareness a reason as to why we experience suffering. But when you and I experience suffering through no direct fault of our own, that's another thing entirely. This is the suffering of Christ. This is the suffering that he endured through no direct fault of his own. And so the book of Job describes suffering that is not the direct result of any action on the part of Job, his wife, or his family. As such, Job is seen struggling, as we struggle today, with a series of crisis events in his life beyond a proportion that many in this world, many of us will ever know. The consequential loss of family, personal property, position, prestige, and the advent of serious illness and organic chronic suffering were not the direct result of any sinful action on the part of Job. This fact leads to one of the great implied questions when one begins to wrestle with the Job text as a whole. And that is, will a man remain faithful to God and serve him in the face of such, quote, unfair, unquote, suffering? After Job suffered his initial loss, he very quickly comes to realize that he himself had done nothing to bring this deep level of suffering upon himself or upon his wife, and therefore he maintained his innocence. It should be kept in mind that Job is not declaring that he is sinlessly perfect. Rather, he is affirming that on a conscious level, he is not aware of any action on his part that would have resulted in the consequential suffering that he was having to endure. You and I, as Christians, are going to be called upon to bear with suffering and actions that we did not bring upon ourselves. Jesus wanted us to know that all who would live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. We don't bring that upon ourselves. That is a direct result of our relationship to God. To the friends of Job, he sounded arrogant beyond description as they beheld a pitiful man suffering the throes of loss and degradation while vainly attempting to affirm that he, Job, had done nothing to deserve such treatment by God. They misunderstood. The perspective of the friends of Job is still very much in vogue today among many people who treat suffering as a direct consequence of sinful behavior and who look at the sufferer with a raised eyebrow of suspicion as having done something grievous to deserve the suffering which they have brought upon themselves and others. Now, these two views of suffering make up a very important aspect in the book of Job and help those of us today living in the same environment. And I would just affirm that our environment today is no better than it was in Job's time, to make sense of the suffering that we face in our own lives. In essence, when is suffering the direct consequence of our own sinful behavior, and when is suffering the product of events beyond our control and based upon no direct fault of our own? The Bible talks about two types of suffering. This latter form of suffering, which Job endured through no direct fault of his own, and which all of us will in some way face in our lives, may be styled as undifferentiated suffering. The primary question in the book of Job is therefore, how much undifferentiated suffering will an individual endure before he or she loses faith and renounces God? It is much easier to bear the kind of suffering which may be styled as differentiated suffering, as we can consciously point to reasons why we have brought such suffering upon ourselves through our own behavior or actions. However, it is truly agonizing to contemplate undifferentiated suffering when, after a personal inventory of our own actions, thoughts, and behaviors, we come to the conclusion that we've done nothing to bring this suffering upon ourselves. Life simply happens. The question that the book of Job directs our way is, how will I respond as an individual Christian to suffering that I cannot attribute to any cause or effect? Will I remain faithful to God in times of suffering? Will I continue to be steadfast in my relationship to God while having to bear the burden of this type of suffering? The book of Job teaches us that there is a better and healthier way to understand some of the suffering that we are called upon to endure in this lifetime. We must first recognize that such suffering as undifferentiated suffering is not the result of our own sinful behavior, and we must therefore be careful not to allow life issues that we will face, usually more than one life crisis at a time, to cause us to lose faith in God and hope in our spiritual inheritance. Second, after taking a personal inventory of our attitude and behavior and finding that we have committed no trespass to bring such suffering upon ourselves, we must be very careful to take these matters to God in prayer. Philippians chapter 4, verses 4 through 9. And to draw nearer to God through His Word, as well as to anchor our hope in the love and providence of God, that in the end all will be well because God rules in the kingdoms of men, that right will reign, and that like Job, we too shall stand justified by the sacrificial blood of the mediator, the Messiah, who shed His blood at the cross on our behalf. Well, the book of Job talks about this type of suffering. This type of suffering that is important for us to understand. Now, between these two questions, number one, will a man serve God for God's sake alone? And number two, why should an innocent individual suffer? Lies an individual who is confused, lies an individual who is hurting and perplexed by the chaos surrounding all of the events, and above all, wondering, where is God? You may be surprised to find out that this person is not Job, but rather it is his wife of many years who has been equally, if not more, devastated by feelings of loss and abandonment. Job's wife is rarely treated in this way. She is rarely seen as a wife and mother who has suffered tremendous loss. Rarely is she seen with the sensitivity necessary to learn the lessons that only Job's wife can teach us. And she has many amazing lessons to teach us in this book. Even though she remains nameless, yet her figure and her faith reign supreme. Indeed, a careful and sensitive look at Job provides an almost evolutionary awareness or awakening regarding both the institution or the aspect of suffering, humanity, and the example of Job's wife. It is unfortunate that some interpret Job chapters 1 and 2 through the dusty lens of what we may call Protestant commentary tradition, where Job's wife is given little, if any, consideration at all. And there are these tremendous lessons that are missed. The name of the book in the earliest Hebrew manuscripts is styled simply as Job. And while we think that this book is all about Job, it is, as we have seen, also about his wife. This book opens with a beautiful presentation, does it not, of a very close family, as we've mentioned already, a loving family, about a father who cared for his children and their families, as well as a mother who, although she remains in the background as far as the biblical narrative is concerned, nevertheless, by implication, had to have been a powerful and stabilizing force within this particular family. Indeed, to Job's wife, as to the vast majority of godly women today, the most valuable thing in her life was her interaction with her husband and with her family. That's true for wives and mothers today. In fact, she understood better than anyone what social researchers of the ancient Near Eastern world have come to realize. And that is, the family was the strongest institution in the ancient world. And we know that godly women were the primary reason why. Therefore, we need to understand as never before that the church today is comprised of local congregations made up of converted individuals and families. Now, an important lesson is that the local congregation is only as strong as the individual members which make up that membership. And therefore, modern threats, many of them, we take as threats against the church, and they are modernism and liberalism and immorality and perversion. All of these things as threats to the church are threats to the family institution. And godly mothers stand up against such threats. Godly fathers stand up against such threats. Why? Because when the family falls and collapses, the church necessarily is going to do the same thing, congregation after congregation after congregation. What keeps the church strong are strong families that make up the membership of the body of Christ. And therefore, understanding Job's wife is important. As many men read the first two chapters of Job, we see, and I'm including myself in this, we see and sense and we identify with Job. His loss of position, his loss of power, his loss of property, his loss of social prestige. However, when a woman reads the same chapters, I think it's interesting. Her awareness painfully focuses on the loss of family. Job's wife suffered tremendous loss. In her mind, we could easily sympathize with her feeling that she had lost everything. It is precisely at this point that the question is raised, how much can we lose before we are ready to renounce God? In essence, number one, Is there a price on your faith? Number two, will an individual serve God for God's sake alone? And number three, is there any such thing as purely disinterested goodness in serving God? And now witness the suffering of Job's wife. Here you have a woman who has been devastated by the loss of her children, by the loss of her grandchildren and her sons-in-law, by property. In the ancient Near Eastern world, as in our world today, these relationships gave her and give wives and mothers today life beyond value and meaning. As such, she felt abandoned and with no purpose left in life. What is her role if not as a wife and a mother? As such, she is depicted in this literary narrative, inspired by God, as being in the deep throes of a very real trauma. And her statement to her husband Job, "Dost thou still hold fast thine integrity, renounce God and die?" This statement by Job's wife must be understood from the point of view of a suffering woman who is asking, "What is the point of going on? Is there any reason to live? We have lost everything." Indeed, she is suffering. She is beside herself. She may be what we might term or call irrational. But listen closely to what she is saying. Is there any point to continuing living in this world? From a mind that had been stricken with so much loss and grief, she is telling her husband Job, "Just curse God and do yourself in." And now this is important. We have no reason to believe that she was not going to be far behind her husband in this. Now for us today, her statements are most compelling. Is life worth living if you lose everything? That is, everything that you have brought into your life or attached to your life, which gives your life meaning? We might ask you tonight, who are you? And how you answer really determines what you place value in. Someone asks you, "Well, who are you?" You give them a name. But you're not your name. You may say, "Well, I am an attorney," or "I'm a plumber," or "I'm an electrician," or "I'm a physician." That's not who you are. That's what you do to engage in livelihood. Who are you? "I'm an individual that lives in such and such of a neighborhood, or drives this type of automobile, or has this type of retirement, or has this much money in the bank, or the type of individual that takes a vacation such and such of a place." Well, that's not who you are. Many times our sense of our own identity in the United States of America is made up by the things that we possess rather than upon a direct relationship with God. Who are you? We ought to say, "I'm a child of God. I'm a Christian. I am a blood-bought servant of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's who I am." But many times we answer based upon our attachments in this world. Well, this is important for us today. In fact, these statements are important. Precisely on this point, it is well to remember history regarding the death of Socrates, who drank the hemlock in committing suicide. Now, those who are not familiar enough with the history may think that that was a horrible thing for Socrates to do, that he was forced to do it, but he was not. He was motivated to do it. He had a choice. He could have left Athens, or he could commit suicide. Socrates chose to commit suicide rather than to leave the city of human philosophy. Why? Because to Socrates, life was not worth living if he could not live and teach in the city that he had helped to make so famous in the world of that day and time. What if you and I lost all of our material possessions? What would it take? Would we renounce God? The similar temptation for many men is to attach their self-worth and value and success to power, prestige, positions, whereas throughout history, The family institution has been the very center of that which gives a righteous woman her feelings of worth, value, identity, and success. And Job's wife, as women today, are no different. How did Job's wife cope in the face of such tragic adversity? How does any woman cope with this type of loss? In studying this passage, the wife of Job quickly comes into focus. She is seen as a real woman in crisis and in a period of genuine suffering. And when you begin to understand everything that this woman had been through, which is really for us an impossibility, everything that this woman had lost, it is here that her cry of anguish toward her husband raises an important question. How much can you lose before you directly blame God? Who else could she direct her anger toward? Job's wife had experienced such a crisis that she had reached a point in her life where it was difficult for her to see that God could have allowed those tragic events to have occurred, or that God would have had any part in a future with Job and his wife. In this sense, no doubt she felt abandoned by God. Let us stop and think about those times in our lives when in the advent of suffering that we did not bring upon ourselves, maybe because of an illness, maybe because of consequential circumstances beyond our control, and we suffer, and we begin to wonder, where is God? Why is it that when I pray so fervently, things continue to go wrong? Why is it that when I study the Bible and seek to apply Christian principles in my everyday life, that I am more persecuted and am made to bear up under more suffering? Why? We're prone to ask many times in our lives. Well, in this interpretation of the opening chapters of the book of Job, we learn that Job's wife, the mother of his children, had experienced as much of a loss, if not more, than Job himself. After all, she physically, emotionally, psychologically bore and helped to rear the children. This woman had a tremendous investment in her family, which gave her worth and value and identity. And she had as much right to feel loss as did Job. What is the point of going on when God abandons you? Sometimes in our own lives, many of us, compelled by the circumstances of life, have asked the same question. Is Christianity really worth all that I am required to give? We do not have to suffer the loss that Job suffered or that Job's wife suffered before we are tempted to ask this or similar questions. All it takes in our lives is a mini crisis, an unexpected jolt, and in our desperation, anxiety, and frustration, for a brief moment, we seemingly are ready to give up. That may be the real test and the real lesson for us this evening as far as Job's wife is concerned. After all, she is left virtually alone. The voices of her own children, grandchildren, and family silenced by devastating and by evil forces. She's left feeling incredibly angry, empty, and wondering, where is the meaning in my life now? At my age, how can I rebuild what I have lost? Where did my life go? These are questions that all of us, at some point in our lives, are going to ask, based upon the suffering that some of us are called upon to endure. Her own children are no more. Her extended family is no more. Her home and her concept of family have been taken away with a savage cruelty that is almost beyond description. Almost. Almost. And here is another lesson that Job's wife teaches us today. Indeed, there is an explanation, even if in our sorrow and grief we fail to see or recognize it. And when we look for answers to our own suffering, there she is, the wife of Job, ready to teach us today. She lost everything. Her presence and voice are silent for the majority of the book. And then she re-emerges as a faithful witness to the incredible grace and glory of God. She experienced and endured the fire of suffering which transforms all of us if we remain faithful. And she was transformed because of her faith and her continued belief in God. Look at the motif in Job. From paradise given in chapter 1 to paradise lost to paradise restored. This transformation motif in the book of Job declares God's love and grace to those who struggle and persevere and continue to remain faithful despite all odds. For those who experience a sense of profound loss or disruptive change, a process of eternal and internal grieving may expectedly result. Typically, this process of grieving affects four areas of life. The mental effects. These would include temporary yet problematic periods of forgetfulness, lack of concentration and inability to focus. Speech and thinking patterns become regressive and problematic. Number two, the physical effects of suffering. Those in a state of grieving are four times more likely to become ill in the first 18 months after loss. An individual may experience physical and or physiological changes during the grieving process. Number three, the emotional effects. Number four, the spiritual effects. Suffering such as that brought about by the process of grieving will test our dependency upon God. But friends, we need to know that grief can lead to a compromise of convictions, and we need to remember what Paul wrote in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 13 for Christians today, "For we sorrow not, even as others who have no hope, because we have hope." Job's wife had hope. The process of grieving, like a territorial map, has at least four phases that individuals pass through to the process of wholeness. First, there is the initial experience of pain and loss. Here's Job and his wife introduced to us. Second, there is the eventual acceptance of the reality of loss. Third, there is the shifting to a more grounded adjustment to a new living environment or situation. And number four, the individual learns to reframe and refocus their energy in other areas that help them to become grounded once again in living a spiritually productive life. And here we have Job in the closing chapters of this monumental book. She made it through to the glory and the grace of God. Job's love for his wife. Job played a significant part in his wife's spiritual survival. When she was at the lowest point of her existence, Job provided the stability, support, and grounding that she needed in order for her to encourage her to maintain faith in God. This is a tremendous lesson for husbands today who must be strong and a strong source of spiritual support in the family. In fact, if the family is to survive intact in today's world, neither the husband or the wife alone should be required to provide all of the spiritual motivation. Rather, both must work together, strengthening one another, encouraging one another, and lifting one another up. This is precisely what we have in Job 2, verses 9 and 10, as Job does what any faithful and loving husband would do. He provides the spiritual perspective necessary for his wife to realize that all is not lost. Job said to his wife, "Thou speakest as one of the foolish women." What? "Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we also not receive evil?" Job 2:10. When Job spoke these words to his wife, it is important to understand that he did not say that they had been abandoned by God. That he did not say that his wife was a foolish woman. Instead, he told her that she was speaking as a foolish woman speaks, which was not her true character. Job said to his wife, implying and reminding her that she was a wise woman, a spiritually minded woman, and she should not succumb to that type of thinking, and neither should Christians today. As a loving husband, Job is a solid support to his wife, as he does not allow her to be led off in her own emotions and in her own suffering. In one of the most tender and spiritually minded actions recorded anywhere in the Bible, Job reaches out to his wife even from his own suffering and reminds her, "Do not be like the foolish who deny God." He reached out to comfort his wife, to help provide direction to her thinking, to encourage her, and to help bring her back to spiritual awareness and grounding. And here Job, scraping himself with a potsherd as he suffers, remains a conscious, faithful, devoted husband in seeking to help his wife understand what the secular mind alone can never understand. Faith in God. Enduring suffering, for in the end, our reward is greater than the suffering that we are called upon to endure.